Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody. Hey Scott the Preacher. That's right, last time. Sit down everybody, spit out your gum, open your mind. Page one. That's what I like to hear, Scotty. On the you are on the magic carpet ride of contending for truth radio.
How do you like that?
That's what you call his post there, Scott. What do you think about
that?
Who's on the show today, Scott?
Scott! What do you got?
I know you're there. I can hear you breathing.
I know. It's hard to tell. Hey, there we go. Hey, we got to have a great show today, Rodney. It's 9-11. It's the 13th anniversary, and so far so good. We've had a pretty good day. Did some watching some videos and remembering our troops, and it's a day for patriots, and we're going to have some discussion about that. Of course, we got Joe the plumber is on the line with us right now. We're going to have Jennifer Cabaney, and we're going to also have your doctor, Dr. Brownstein, on at the end. And then we've got you hooked us up with a fun looking guest, Benjamin Smith, former Navy SEAL. Looked over his website, and it's different stuff that's on the internet about him. He looks like quite the character. So it looks like it's going to be great.
Yeah, this guy is the real deal, man. And he actually, Joe Wurzelbacher, who we all know as Joe the Plumber, is originally hooked us up with Ben, and we've been trying to get him on the show. And hopefully tonight we'll make a connection, and we're going to have a good time. And I'm sure he's got one or two insights into 9/11. I have a feeling he got plenty to say about it, but you're right. I've been watching TV all day and hoping that nothing happened. And I'm kind of glad that at least Hillary Clinton isn't in charge of the State Department. Should something happen on the anniversary of 9/11, we all know what the debacle that was, 9/11, when Hillary was running things over there at the State Department, and the terrible tragedy in Benghazi, Libya, when four Americans lost their lives. And boy, to this day, more and more is still coming out of there. More and more information, everything from subject that you're very familiar with, running guns over there, you know, in and out of Libya, in and out of Egypt, in and out of Syria. You don't know what the heck's going on anymore, but you do know this. That woman is just lying her ass off, and I guess she just gets to run for president anyway, doesn't she? I don't get it.
You know, I don't get it either. And the more days go by, the more lies come out on all sides, all the way around it. And I just hope as we go through history, it goes down in history for what the truth of it was.
Well, Joe's here. Hey, Joe, you're on count over you today. I'm glad you called in. Say hi to Scott the Preacher. And looks like we at least toward the end of the day, we got through 9/11 unscathed. What do you think about that?
I'm happy, still praying that it continues to be the case at the end of the day. So, you know, the last thing we want to lose is any more Americans out there, especially with Barack Obama at the helm. And as far as lying and running for president, well, hell, I get it. You know, I mean, Bill Clinton, you know, define what is. I mean, that just seems to be a standard anymore to lie, cheat, and steal, manipulate the position that you're in, and you know, run the greatest country in the world into the ground. I mean, that's what anybody's going to do now, and that's what's going to move forward. I mean, the office of President of the United States of America used to be very esteemed, used to be absolutely incredible. People, you know, looked to America and everything. And anything that was happening on the world stage, America held that position of, okay, what's America going to do? How's America going to solve it? And unfortunately, anymore, Barack Obama has destroyed that in his first 4 years, and he's you know, bearing it in his second 4 years. So You know, the only way we're going to beat this old drum again, we got to get states to get strong again. We got to get America back on target, and it's going to be the states that do it.
Are you torn, though, like I am? Because there is that element, especially when it comes to Barack Obama, but this is true of all politics, but it's really illustrated in Barack Obama's second term. And what I mean by that is, listen, you can say that he lied, and you can say that he did this, you can say that he did that, but guess what? He got reelected. So I'm not excusing it, I'm not condoning it, but in his mind, it's like, well, this is what they want. I'm going to give them more of it. I mean, does that ever enter into it for you? Because it's like that old saying, you get the government you deserve, right?
No, it's absolutely true. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of conservatives stayed home the second time around, and that's on us. You know, we're not taking the fight to the people. We're not making it known that this is actually a fight. This is war. You know, we have to fight for our way of life. And unfortunately, people aren't hearing the passion. They're not hearing enough of it. And so that's why you, Rodney, and Scott, and Ben Smith, and Jennifer, and myself, and hundreds of others, but we need to be thousands, hundreds of thousands, beating the pavement, you know, doing what the liberals have been doing for the last 20 to 30 years. You know, we're playing catch-up, but they need to know that passion. We need to spread the word that, you know, we're fighting for our way of life. And speaking of that, you know, I don't like really talking about politicians too often, but I tell you what, Ted Cruz did a solid. My
yeah.
God, that man actually spoke up and defended what I defend on a regular basis, what you defend, what Scott I know defends. You know, if you're not with, you know, if you don't stand up for Christians, you know, you don't stand up for Israel. And you know, if you hate Israel, you hate America. If you hate Jews, you hate Christians. I mean, this guy just put it right there on the line, and I got to applaud him for that. That was just solid. And, you know, if he does a couple more things like that, you know, color me impressed.
Yeah, he's really showing some leadership quality. Of course, he always has shown some very unique leadership quality. I've just been really praying that he holds that. You know, he holds that line. And you know, we've talked about Ted Cruz a lot. And we've talked about, hey, you know, he got swept into office. He defeated a very powerful, very popular establishment Republican, Texas Republican, and just kicked his ass with the grassroots effort, with a Tea Party effort. And then, you know, there was a question of, like, well, wait a minute, he's not mentioning Tea Party anymore. And, you know, is he doing that just because he's going to run for president, or is he waffling? God, I hope not. And, you know, and you're right. And he showed his chops today, or was it yesterday, when he was started to get heckled at an event that he was invited to for merely saying that he stands behind Israel. And it's like, wait a minute, you're right. You got to tell it like it is. And if people are hooting and hollering, and I don't care if they invited you there or not, it's like, hey, buddy, screw you. And he walked off stage and said exactly what you said, Joe. And so I was very happy to see that. And boy, we sure do need a hero. And I said as much when I had the opportunity to introduce Senator Cruz. I was really I got to do it twice in the last year and a half, and it's really the highlight of my career, and it probably always will be. And I said these words. I said, we need a hero. We need, every 30 or so years, or 30 or 40 years, the Republican Party needs a hero. And I think I found him, and it's Ted Cruz. I just hope that he is the guy, because I don't see anybody else. I really don't. I mean, I like this guy, Jeff Sessions. I really do. He's got a nice editorial in the National Review today all about the absurdity, just the absurdity going on in the Senate. I mean, it's beyond anything that even Democrats could even think about, even 15, 20 years ago. The leader of the Senate, Harry Reid, is applauding the idea that President Obama will use executive action to enact amnesty for what they say is 5 to 6 million people. Of course, we all know what that means, 30 to 40 million people. But what that is, this amnesty is immediate citizenship, legalization, citizenship, ID cards, Social Security numbers, driver's license, access to 100% benefits, and then, of course, minority set-asides. 5 or 6 million people by executive action. We got the leader of the Senate applauding Obama doing that. Now, this is the guy that's running Congress. He's saying this is great for the president to go around Congress. This is, it's absurd. And it's like, wow, can you even believe it?
Oh, I can. It's like a bad cartoon, but they're using our money. I mean, it's almost, you know, to the point that people don't really pay attention to Congress or Senate anymore. I mean, when's the last time they actually done anything? I mean, think about it. I mean, really, when have they actually done anything?
Well,
the Republicans have had plenty.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You know, you got this guy, Harry Reid, that talk about a lapdog. And meantime, on the side, he's getting rich with all that those land deals. And he's actually applauding the president ignoring the separation of powers and just shredding the Constitution, ignoring any checks and balances on that side. And then on this side, meaning the conservative or Republican side, you got Boehner and McCarthy and you know, you got Cantor before him completely abdicating the power of the purse, which is one of the most powerful items in the Constitution, Article 1. Just completely saying, basically, the other day, Paul Ryan just came out and said, well, you know what, we can't do that. We can't defund. He basically said, we have no power of the purse. I mean, the man is insane. He was running for vice president a couple years ago saying that. So we got both leaders, all the leaders in the Congress going, well, you know, Barack Obama, you know, that's kind of how he rolls, you know.
Oh, you're making my point for me, what I said earlier upon the opening of the show is, you know, separation of powers is gone. You know,
yes.
Barack Obama is pretty much doing what he wants to do. So it's up to the states to bring this back to where it needs to be. You know, Article 5, you know, there's some things that the states can do and should do and need to do. And that's what I think we need to talk about at great length on your show as we move forward, give people more information on that, and let them know that, you know, the states do have the power to you know, make the federal government work for them yet again. It's just we got to exercise that power. We got to get strong state representatives, strong state governors. And you know what? It wouldn't hurt to have a president that would listen to us. You know, and yeah, I don't know if Ted Cruz is that guy, but, you know, like I say, he's showing some gumption, and maybe he will be that guy for America.
I hope so. But, you know, I was listening to Levin the other day, who was kind of spearheading that whole Article 5 a year ago when he wrote the book, The Liberty Amendments. And he kind of got that whole, I mean, I know we've been talking about it for longer than that, but he kind of got the discussion going nationally. And a caller brought up a great point, and it was, hey, let's say, and it's going to take a long time, but that's fine. It takes a long time to turn around a big ship. And America has a pretty big turning radius when it comes to correcting things. Obama, bless his heart, people are always saying, well, what a failed presidency is. And I say, wait a minute, this guy's got a lot done in a very short period of time. I wouldn't exactly call that a failure. You know, I mean, it's maybe not what we want, but it sure is successful from his standpoint, if you ask me. And it's going to take a long time to turn it around, certainly through the state legislatures. But it can be done legally. It should be done, and it should be started now. And a caller brought up a great point, and that is, let's say we do get it done, Joe. Let's say we get it all done, Scott, and then the federal government just decides to not obey it, for lack of a better phrase, not observe it as legitimate. And I thought, wow, what do we got on our hands then? Do you think? I mean, Scott, what, chime in here. What happens when the states say one thing, and the federal government goes, well, you know, we kind of don't agree with you there. And they haven't been following the Constitution for maybe several years by then. What are we doing then?
Exactly. And I think we find ourselves in the same boat we're in right now. I think we're in a constitutional crisis. We've got our federal government's not following the Constitution. That's not a partisan thing. It's not a bipartisan thing. It's both sides anymore, which is really, really what's scary. You know, I was watching an interview with General Villely and General McInerney the other day, and they said we might be at a point in a constitutional crisis where the military just has to go in and arrest Barack Obama, especially on supporting our enemies and some of these other things. And I just have to say, if we're at where we're at right now, what's to say that they're going to follow anything else that comes along with the with a convention, an Articles of the Convention? What? There's no evidence in my book that they would follow it. I would think they would probably ignore it.
That's what I was thinking. And Joe, do you know Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona? Because I read an article today where he said
I know Sheriff
that,
Joe real well.
Yeah, he said that he's going to arrest Barack Obama before his term is out. He was quoted as saying that. Sheriffs are very powerful.
Well, they are, and a lot of American people don't understand the power that sheriffs hold. That being said, going back to what your question though to Scott, I wanted to comment on is, I'm not making a call to arms here right now. We need to take our government back, but this is a step in the right direction, with the Article 5 conventions and doing something along those lines. I would want to try that, regardless if, the federal government decided to ignore it or not. This would be a step we need to take, to right the ship. Now, say they did ignore it after it was done and said. Because, doing it's important. It makes it legal. It's us, the American people, following the Constitution, following the law. We're putting action behind our words, and that's very important. You have to show that we're not above the law. We're doing everything step by step, and this would be the next step in doing that. And so I think it's important first to do it, and then, obviously if the federal government decided they didn't want to follow the laws, I think there's more than enough people out there in America that would make it happen. One way or another, it would happen. But we have to be under the law. Right now these people are acting above the law, and that's what's got our goat. That's what's making us so angry. So we can't act unilaterally and decide, we need to go up there with our guns and just, and have at it. No, we need to be within the law to make everything right.
Absolutely, and that's what's the key to it, is we have to go in with the full force of the law and never be outside of the law. The first time I really started thinking about this was when Cliven Bundy had his standoff with the federal authorities. I actually drove up there. I think you remember this. I drove up there for Joe for America. And I would be remiss, my friends, if I didn't mention the owner of JoeForAmerica.com is on the line with us, Joe Wurzelbacher. That's JoeForAmerica.com for all of your politics, pop culture, and entertainment news. I went up there ready to do a story and take some video for Joe for America, and I never could get close enough because they had everything blocked off. But I was listening to the radio and watching TV when I eventually doubled back and went to Las Vegas, where I belong. And I was watching the news accounts. And I'm just, at that time a casual observer and thinking about what I was going to write in a column. And it occurred to me when they cut to these snipers on the overpass, and these were snipers that were going to were there helping Cliven Bundy. And I thought, I'm not worried about these snipers. What I'm worried about is, what if one of these federal agents, gets nervous and takes a shot, because they've already gotten nervous and maced Mr. Bundy's son, and I saw a video where they sicked these German Shepherd dogs on him, and maybe he deserved it, maybe he didn't. You don't see the whole thing, but that's not the point. What if some guy gets nervous and pops a couple rounds? It doesn't. You don't even have to hit anybody. You might shoot over somebody's head. Well, then you got a domino effect. The sniper, blows off a round, near one of the sheriffs or near one of the the land management guys. Next thing you know, a couple of guys go down. Then what do you do? My God, it's Kent State or worse. And then you've got serious problems. And in my mind, I was just playing it out, going, Jesus, I mean, that would be terrible over a stupid land. And I shouldn't say stupid because it's not, but over, you know, in the big picture, it's a land dispute. And the stupid federal government shouldn't be sending their agents out there like that to confront a rancher. He said, you know, okay, they've got a dispute. Work it out. And then it turns out, sure enough, Harry Reid and his cronies, they've got money to be made. And that's why they're trying to get everybody off all the land, and it just gets deeper and deeper and deeper. But, man, what if a couple of guys would have got killed on either side? Now you've got the American people against the federal government in an armed standoff. I mean, that's when I first started really thinking about it, Joe and Scott. And now we're talking about, okay, we do everything legal. We use Article 5. We have some strong governors, and we use the state legislature to get the Constitution amended. And what, I mean, I agree with both of you guys. I see no evidence where either party would look at that and pay any mind to it. They would just say, well, you know, this is what it is, and we're the government, and screw you. And what do you do then? I mean, what the heck do you do? I don't have an answer, but, man. I agree, Joe, though. We need to do it. We need to follow through with every constitutional power available, because clearly the Republicans are not going to.
No, not at all.
Your thoughts.
No, I agree with you. Our Republican Party is just as complicit as the Democrat Party. You know, moving forward, if we continue underneath a two-party system like we have, then, you know, in 10, 20, 30 years, you know, it's going to be a lot of, you know, I used to remember when America was like this. I used to remember when I could go do this. You know, I used to remember, you know, sitting outside with my gun across my lap shooting prairie dogs, and now I can't do that because, well, they took my rifle away. I used to remember when America used to be free. And I, you know, I don't want to be on the end of that stick. I don't want to used to remember nothing. You know, that's why we're here, boys. This is what we're made to do. This is what God has called us to do, and God's calling a lot of other Americans to step up and be heard and do the right thing. A
couple of things really pisses me off, Joe, and that is, first of all, the Republicans who have no interest in conservatives, even though 2010 the conservatives are who put the Republicans into power, into the most powerful chamber, which I think the House of Representatives is, because it's the people's house, and it is indeed, it has the power of the purse. Listen, the House of Representatives has the power to shut the government down, and people look at that like a negative, and I look at it like, no, that's a positive. You got the power to shut the government down? Buddy, you got the power. You can say, no, we'll shut the government down before we do that. And everybody, you know, stupid Mitch McConnell's like, well, no, we'll never shut the wall. You won't see us. Hey, screw you. If I don't like what's going on, we're shutting this thing down. We're shutting it down right now. And they should have shut it down over Obamacare. They should have shut it down until Obamacare withered on the vine and just went away. But no, they didn't. And that's one thing that pisses me off, is that the Republicans have abdicated that power, and they've turned against the conservatives, and they take money. The Republican Party, my Republican Party, and Scott the Preacher had to talk me off the ledge, and it wasn't that long ago, 6 months ago, because I've been a Republican activist for over 25 years, and Joe, you've been the same. And, you know, I mean, let's face it, we only have one party to go to. It's Republicans. We can't be in the Democrat Party. And, you know, after all those years, they don't even want me. They hate me. Republicans hate me. They take money from George Soros and these labor unions, and they want to destroy me, and they want to destroy all good conservative candidates and voters, and they want us just to go home and shut the hell up, you know? And that, number one, that pisses me off. That really pisses me off. And the second thing that pisses me off is once we have picked a candidate, whether we like it or not, once we get our guy, it's like a quarterback going into a game. Once the quarterback has been picked, you got to get behind it, man. You can't take your ball and go home like we did with Romney. You can't go, well, you know, he's not conservative. Romney can, you know. You can't do that, guys. You got to get behind him and vote for him. Okay, he's not the perfect candidate. He wasn't my guy either. But guess what? You happy with Obama? Craig, and can you imagine how much better this country would be with Romney? Well, what would we be now? We'd be the second year into a Romney presidency? Who knows? Obamacare might even be repealed by now, or substantially. He might have taken executive order and said, this is unconstitutional, gone. You don't know, but it certainly would be better. But no, conservatives stayed home like little babies, like little spoiled brat. We didn't get our guy. Oh, really? Well, who was your guy? Ron Paul? Who was your guy? Rick Perry? Who was your guy? Guess what? He didn't win. I'm sorry he didn't. Newt Gingrich didn't win. Romney won. Get in there and back our guy. He's now your guy. Okay? Herman Cain was my guy. Herman Cain, Wisconsin. I'm pretty Joe. You backed him as well. Okay,
he didn't
get in there. We're sad that he didn't get in there. We can sit here and piss and moan and make all kinds of excuses and blah blah blah. But he's not in there. So get in there. And that's the second thing that pisses me off. And it equals Barack Obama president. And it equals the Republicans a bunch of pussies, as you and I have often said, Joe.
Oh, absolutely, without a doubt, brother. But, you know, like you said, you got to get in there. You got to move forward. And, you know, regardless if Mitt Romney was the perfect candidate, and I'd be the first one to tell you he is not. But, you know, there is a saying, I'll play a little devil's advocate. You know, when you pick the lesser of two evils, you're still getting evil.
I know, but we had no choice. We got one going against another.
I know, but that's what a lot of people are thinking, Rodney. That's why I'm putting it out there.
Okay, think that way, but now you got Barack Obama. Okay, Romney gets in there and he's president because we all get behind him, we get in there. Okay, now we're doing the show. The three of us are doing a show, and we're bagging on Romney, and we're pushing him further to the right. I'm serious. In 2016, now we're running a guy to the right of Romney. Now we inch toward the right. You can't just – listen, it doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work that way, and you're going to –
I'm not disagreeing with you, Rodney. I'm just telling you that's kind of the mindset out there.
Yeah,
that's
it is.
That's why, you know, we failed miserably in getting Barack Obama defeated.
You're right, and the left is so much better at sticking together. And you know what? You know what's really funny? And Scott, I want you to comment on this. We got Hillary Clinton now. And Scott, I don't know if you know this, Joe, but Scott and I have these big discussions about Hillary Clinton, whether or not she's going to run in 2016. So I got a point I really want to make here about Hillary Clinton, but I must have Scott jump in here, if you're there, Scott. I must have Scott jump in here and tell me if and why Hillary still is not running in 2016, because I haven't talked to you about it in a couple of days. What do you think?
I know, a couple of days. Well, you know,
yeah.
I'll tell you, I don't think health is good. I really don't think she wants it at this point.
Still?
I really think she knows that the country really doesn't want to go down a second Clinton or a third Bush. But I'll tell you what she does know, and Hillary Clinton and the Clintons are brilliant politicians. She does know that if she continues to move forward looking like she's going to run, it's raising all kinds of money. But I have thought for years that she's not really going to run. That Barack Obama, when she lost that to him, that was it. Some of the closer people to them, such as Larry Nichols, who was their very, very close friend until he came out and helped Monica's dress show up, and other people have said the same thing basically over the years, that she really doesn't want it anymore, that she wants to retire, she wants to kick back, and so I do. I think she's going to keep acting like she's running as long as it raises money. Then when it comes time to jump in, I think she's going to say sayonara.
Well, I still think she's going to run, and I respectfully disagree with you, and I'll tell you something else that really is wild. And we got this woman, Elizabeth Warren. Now, you two are both familiar with her. She's the woman in Massachusetts who has successfully run for the Senate. She is now a senator from Massachusetts in a long, long, proud line of senators from Massachusetts. All of her life, she has claimed that she is part Native American, I believe Cherokee. She had got into Harvard partially based on the fact that she was a minority. She has enjoyed minority set-asides, and she's moved up the social and political ladder in part, you know, based on her minority status, the stories, the press releases. Oh, look at this. Isn't this fantastic? A Native American, blah, blah, blah. They finally looked into it, and what? Turns out she's not an Indian. She's never been an Indian. She's not part Indian. There's nothing Indian about her, but that doesn't matter. She doesn't care, and it doesn't matter to Democrat voters, that big lie. They voted her in as senator anyway, despite the fact that she's been taking these minority set-asides all these years that were meant for actual minorities, actual Native Americans, but that's okay. That's okay. In fact, she's running for president now, I hear. They're trying to get her to run in the primary. They asked her about, yeah, oh, and she won't give up. She will not give up, folks. They asked her about, what does she think about Hillary, you know, as a potential candidate, and she said, woman with big pantsuit, speak with forked tongue. See, she won't give up. She won't give up any of it. Many moons since big pantsuit come over mountain. She said that instead of a teleprompter, she's going to use smoke signals. She actually said that. Now, there is one thing I agree with her. You guys are supposed to be laughing, by the way. There is one thing I agree with her. She says they should force the Washington Redskins to change their name to something less repulsive, like the Maryland Redskins. Thank you. Good night, everybody.
Well, hey, two things on that, two things. One, if they get any more pictures of Hillary Clinton and her moo-moo, there's no way in hell she's going to run. And secondly,
there's no way she can run. Oh, you mean run for office. I'm with you.
And secondly, let's take a look at this. We never go down this path very often. I mean, you did say Elizabeth Warren, but I think that's just a bunch of smoke.
That's right.
But, I mean, really, who would run if Hillary doesn't run? Well, then, you know, God, that opens the field for a lot of Republicans. But let's go down the Democrat, lineup. I mean, Joe Biden? I mean, that...
Yeah, no way.
I'm sorry. I couldn't keep a straight face. I tried.
Well, the guy who's going to run is this guy from San Antonio, Castro, the young Hispanic guy.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, he could, but... I actually know a guy that ran against him when he was running for Congress. Congress. Castro, no, he'll lose it. I mean, who's a serious contender? I mean, there's a lot of throwaways out there, but who's a serious contender on the national level? I mean, Castro, most people don't know him. I know him just because I did some stuff for a guy running for Congress down in San Antonio, but no one knows him. Who's a serious Democratic contender other than Hillary Clinton?
Well, wait a minute. Castro is sitting in the same situation that Obama was. How is it any different?
Yeah, that's right.
And not only that, it's next in line, first Hispanic president.
I think that's exactly who they want. I think Hillary's for show. I think if Hillary were very serious about Hillary, they wouldn't be asking Elizabeth Warren. They wouldn't be asking Castro.
But she's meeting with Castro and talking to him about vice presidency and blah, blah, blah. That's a dream team, buddy.
Well, it is. It is.
Well, you got her.
But
I'm.
I tell you, there's another reason. There is a bunch of pictures of her out there that are very unflattering. And I think somebody that had planning on running for president.
Aren't you telling me that there's actually some out there that is flattering? Come on, please. What do you mean? There's pictures out there that are even less flattering than the ones we've seen.
Oh, there's hundreds of them over the years that have popped up.
Well, how's that going to affect anything? She's not running as a beauty queen. What are you doing? What are you doing, manufacturing a gun? What is that? You can't do that while we're on the air. That's an illegal activity. Listen,
wait
guys.
Wait a minute.
Am I on the air right now?
You got to tell me when you put me on.
You're just listening yet, Jennifer. I haven't introduced you yet. Boy, you are just—you just can't, you know, can't help yourself. Listen, this is Conover, you on contending for truth.
I know
truth.
That sounded awful.
Yes.
Sorry.
This is Conover, you on contending for truth radio. My name is Rodney Lee Conover. I'm here with Scott the Preacher Osborne. With us is the great Joe the Plumber Wurzelbacher, and we got our girl coming on, but I have to introduce her properly. So here we go. That's right. Oh, yeah. Straight over from the college deck.
Take pink ribbon off my eyes. I'm a coach, and it's no big surprise.
Let us know what's going on in the college campus. Here's let us know what's going on with women. Here's some I never know what she's going to say. All I know is that she's going to make Scott the Preacher's face turn red, and me and Joe are going to be hanging on every word she says. Jennifer, how are you? Say hi to everybody.
Good, how are you?
Joe, Scott, and myself.
Hi.
We're all here, waiting with bated breath.
Do they know that you're in love with Gwen Stefani, by the way?
No, it's a secret, but I guess not anymore.
I'm going to tell you right now this.
I guess that one's out of the bag. But I've got good reason to be in love with her.
She serenaded him one time. No, she serenaded him one time, and now he's completely in love with her for the rest of his life.
Well, wouldn't you?
I guess maybe.
Yeah. Well, listen, Jennifer. As I said, Jennifer is over at thecollegefix.com. Hey, Joe, you know Jennifer, right?
Absolutely. Just got done reading one of her... actually, an article you put together, and then one of her writers over at the College Fix put together about a girl running around carrying a mattress.
Yeah, that's a great one. She had sex with her boyfriend. Are we going to do our disclaimer before I start talking and getting into all this crazy campus drama?
Go ahead, do the disclaimer.
Okay.
Or you want me to do it?
Here's
the disclaimer. First of all, Scott the Preacher is a man of the cloth, okay? I, from time to time, quote scripture. I don't know when I do it, but when I do it, it's pretty damn good. Scott interrupts the show, and he explains to everybody how I am quoting scripture and spreading the word. Joe Wurzelbacher is also a really, really strong Christian. He believes in the Word, and he goes to church. He's got a very nice wife, and how many kids you got now? Two, three? We don't even know. He's popping them out everywhere. He doesn't care. I like my cigar, too, but I take it out of my mouth once in a while, Joe. You know what I'm saying? So we got a bunch of Christians on the show. Jennifer.
And I am one.
Yeah, Jennifer comes on the show. Immediately, Scott has to, I think Scott has to open up his Bible so he doesn't burst into flames. And then I don't know what happens after that because my head just starts spinning. But Jennifer, here's what's great about Jennifer. She's a really, really strong Christian. And she takes this Israeli martial arts called Krav Maga. So when you see her, you know, you meet, you say, hey, Jennifer, how you doing? And she's, oh, you know, hi, you know, God bless you. And she kicks you right in the nuts, Joe. She kicks you in the nuts just for no reason, just to keep you wondering about it. And then she starts talking about, you know, college kids. And the truth is, what do college kids talk about? They talk about romance. So, and I don't care if you're Christian or not, men and women roam the earth. And, you know, there's Adam and Eve, and there's the apple, and there's that and that. So once in a while, Jennifer will talk about a subject that makes us a little uneasy, but it's good for us. So everybody, don't call in and complain, okay? Just take it, okay? There you go. There's our disclaimer. Jennifer, tell us about this broad at Columbia University. Now, this is a serious subject, and I'm not going to, you know, make fun, because she is claiming that she was sexually assaulted by her boyfriend, and she's carrying her mattress around. What is up with that?
Well, it's her way of taking a stand against Columbia administrators because she feels that they didn't do what she wanted them to do, which was basically kick them out of school. But I'm still trying to wrap around my head around how your boyfriend, I mean, I suppose your boyfriend can rape you, but...
Of course. And so can your husband. So can any man. I'm not here to suggest that a rape can't take place. Of course it can. But how the reporting goes and how she's handling it, it's like all of a sudden it's performance art, you know, and in my column I said, this is rape, not show and tell, okay? I don't know if you saw
it. Well, no, on college campuses right now, this is the cause du jour among women. In fact, you know, here it is. It's 9/11, right? It's September 11th. It's 13 years since our country changed forever, and we've been fighting a war on terror ever since and radical Islam. And, you know, it's a poignant day. It's a somber day. And guess what they're protesting over at the University of Arizona right now?
What?
They're protesting because some male columnist in a student newspaper had the audacity to offer advice to women on how not to get raped. And some of his advice was, well, don't get wasted. Well, tell your friends where you're going. Well, travel in threesomes. You know, he was just a college guy trying to give college girls, like, common sense advice on how not to get raped.
Why are they mad at that?
Because it's victim blaming. That's what they say. It's victim blaming. Now, as ludicrous as it is for them to protest it, what I got even more upset about, and we have an article on the College Fix about this protest right now, is that they had to choose 9/11 of all days. So,
yeah.
You know, it's bad enough that a guy can't even, like, sincerely say, hey, look, here's what I think, you know, you should do. But then they have to go and protest it on 9/11, so it's a double whammy.
Hey, Joe, you have a daughter, right? You've got a little girl, right?
Yep.
Okay, when your little girl gets older, wouldn't you give her the advice, look, one of the things you don't, certain things you don't want to do. You don't want to go out and get totally wasted at a party where there's a bunch of, you know, teenage boys. And why? Because you're the weaker sex, because of this, because, you know, you're the victim, blah, blah, blah. No, because it's common sense, right?
No, absolutely. But, you know, that's advice I gave my son just a couple years ago, you know, not to get wasted at a party. That's just, that is common sense. But just for everybody listening, as my daughter gets older, she'll be packing a firearm and she will kill anybody that's, inappropriately comes on to her and matter. My wife carries a firearm. My aunts, my, female cousins, my mom, you know, women, I do not want them to be the victim of rape. It's a heinous, disgusting crime, and I hate it.
Scott Osborne, all this talk about firearms, did you have anything to do with the transactions of said firearms? Anything discussed so far? I'm just curious. Seems there's.
I'm not mentioning Grenada.
Okay. Anyway,
it's an important subject, and I'll tell you, it's one that comes home to me, because for about almost 3 years, I fought the fight for Don Miller, who was falsely accused of rape by his girlfriend. Because she wanted to go messing around all night and coming in at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he kicked her out, and she accused him of rape. And the rape shield laws would not let come into court that she had already accused 6 other men of rape before she accused Don Miller. Don Miller was sent to prison under a corrupt system up in Wisconsin for 42 years. He served 16 before kept it up and kept the pressure up until he came home. But I'll tell you what really, really bothers me about this, and I pray for this girl, because what happens 5 years from now if she legitimately gets raped? After she's gone through this process, and the process is going to show this young man's going to get his day in court. This young man, it's going to come out. The truth is going to come out. Young people aren't stupid. And then she turns around, and she has to go through a legitimate rape trial. And I pray that that doesn't happen, but we know that that kind of thing happens. Maybe I watch too much Criminal Minds and Bones, but we know that people like this continue to get worse. I can see her after she's got all this attention, and that's a drug. That kind of attention is a drug. 2 years down the line, she decides she wants to do it again. She wants to get more attention. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why Common Core takes out things like Aesop's Fables and great literature, where you learn some basic concepts like crying wolf. But even if she doesn't end up in that situation, other women, as they really are legitimately raped, are incredibly hindered from prosecuting and getting justice in a real rape situation, when we have women using the rape card as a lottery ticket, as we've seen some do, as an excuse to just be liberal, an excuse to push a liberal agenda, which is basically all she's doing by carrying around this mattress. That mattress is she's a liberal, and this is the way life is, and men suck, and women are all victims. And it's just, man, there's so many legs to this. We could discuss this subject, actually, for about 3 hours and cover a bunch of different legs that go along with this story. But that's the big one to me as it goes on. You know, you got men that are being falsely accused all over the country. And it makes it harder for the women. It really makes it harder for them.
Well, Jennifer, what was your you had an update to that story. And I believe the young woman, or not you, but one of your writers over there at the College Fix, one of the college kids, you're specialized in promoting college journalists, which is terrific. I was one myself. I remember those days, and it's great to see your name in print. I mean, it's just really, really great, and what you guys are doing are great. And we reprint, an article here and there over at joeforamerica.com. I happen to have the owner of joeforamerica.com on the show right now, Joe Wurzelbacher. But what was the update? She did some sort of video with Time Magazine or something? What was that?
You know, I frankly wouldn't be surprised. I'm not sure of the update. I would love to circle back to something that Scott brought up because it got me really excited. And that is this. Scott, I've been following you on Facebook, and I can tell that you hate Common Core as much as I do.
Oh, you better believe it.
You know what? They're taking out the fiction, and that really makes me mad. I volunteer in my kids' classroom, and it's all these nonfiction books. And I'm not trying to say nonfiction is boring, but come on, you know, they're kids, and they like unicorns and knights on horses and, you know, sort of like these fantasy things. Get them excited about reading, and I'm like, the pig went in the mud, you know. The dog went to the park. And I'm just like, you know, these kids, they're taking away their imagination. They're taking away their creativity. And I just can't stand that aspect of Common Core, one of many different things I hate about it. And I want to thank joeforamerica.com for putting my rant against Common Core on its website.
Well, it's doing really well. I mean, I wouldn't, believe me, we wouldn't continue to reprint your articles if they didn't kick ass for us. And I'm should be the one thanking you. And I do thank you. Scott, this is a subject that Scott Osborne knows a heck of a lot about. He's been educating me about it ever since my ill-fated run for Congress. And he really, really brought me up to speed. And Scott, I think you'll agree. I could debate anybody, you know, after my education with Scott Osborne on Common Core. I could debate just about anybody on that subject. So believe me, Scott is with you 100% on this in this particular area. He is homeschooling his kids, and I mean, when you're in the middle of educating kids, I can imagine just be going crazy over this Common Core thing.
What happened to phonics? What happened to sounding words out? The teacher literally told me they can't just sound it out. They have to read it like a snap sight word. They can't sound out a word. What country are? I don't even understand what's going on here with education when you can't teach a child to read by having them sound out words. And then my daughter brings home these homework assignments for math. Nowhere on the sheet does it say addition, subtraction. The whole things are these bizarre Venn diagrams and, you know, little symbols and word problems that I barely can figure out, and I'm just like, oh my God, am I going to have to homeschool? That's how I feel. Because it's just such a horrible way to educate children. They're taking out their creativity, they're, you know, using sight words instead of phonics, and they're offering them fuzzy math, and I'm just like, it worries me. It's frustrating.
Well, and I really don't understand why it's going on in California with the phonics, because California learned their lesson twice on the phonics.
They did.
I was taught with phonics, and shortly after I learned how to read, they took the phonics out of the schools. They found out that sight words don't work. They put it back in, and then they removed it again. They put it back in, and now they're removing it again with Common Core. And I'll tell you, it's serious to me, because I taught my youngest niece to read over the last couple of years. She was reading, writing, and spelling by the time she hit 4 years of age. And I used two things. I used a set of phonics flashcards, and I used the refrigerator with a dry erase pen. And she can read. She's not even six yet. She's reading at a second grade level. And I'll tell you how I my little hit back, Jennifer, to the people that want to take out phonics for the sight words, is I took the list of sight words and taught her how to read them with phonics.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's what I'm doing.
It really does come down to some basic common sense. We have created the greatest nation on the earth, and we did it through basically the one-room schoolhouse. Our greatest generation, most of them were taught in a one-room schoolhouse, using some of the basic tools, a blackboard, and such. And it's insane. One of the reasons why we moved to Texas was to get away from Common Core. Of course, we still got C-Scope down here, and we're still fighting the fight. But for the most part, it's been almost yanked out.
Yeah. Well, keep up the good fight, and you know, maybe I'll move to Texas too eventually. But there was another thing I wanted to talk. I promised Roger
well,
I'd talk about.
I was just about to say we've now come to the R-rated version. We've come to the R-rated part of Con Over You, and that is Scott. I don't know if you want to cover your ears, but you probably don't want to. I'm not going to. And that is, I have to bring up the subject of brassieres. I'll just say that. Jennifer, what is the latest on bras? I ask you.
They're racist.
The what?
They're racist.
Bras are racist?
Yes, bras are racist.
Because so many of them are white?
Exactly. That's
yeah.
Exactly right.
See, I thought that, though. See, that has rushed through my mind as I walk slowly through the lingerie section at Super Walmart and check out all the bras. No, I don't do that. But as you walk by, you notice a lot of the bras are white, and I think, well, maybe not everybody wants a white bra.
No. Here's the thing. We have a real issue going on in this country, right? We have, or across the nation, across the world. Take the Rotherham rapes, right? Here we have a legitimate situation in England where, you know, these young girls are literally, this is real rape. By the way, you mentioned, you know, this is rape, right? These young girls, 11, 12, 13, these English girls are being raped in this Pakistani culture. Horrible, horrible, horrible stories. So as editor of the College Fix, you know, every day I'm reading college newspapers, you know, op-eds, opinion sections, what are the kids fired up about? I've read like dozen plus articles, columns about the atrocities of white privilege, you know. Not one op-ed decrying the Rotherham rapes, not one. But the students are up in arms over white privilege. They can't denounce it enough. And what happened was, most recently, the Oklahoma Daily student newspaper, their editorial board, which is typically the leaders of the newspaper, got together and decided that bras and Band-Aids are racist and an example of white privilege because they don't come in a wide enough span of colors for everybody. And to label a bra, quote-unquote, nude is insensitive and racist because what one person's nude bra might not be another person's nude bra.
Right.
Well, I argued, like, I've never been able to match my bra to my exact skin tone, by the way. So it's kind of impossible. But who cares anyway? I mean,
Do you know that Scott the Preacher's skin tone just changed?
Well, I just, you know, I've been sitting there and been reading this, these kids all outraged because, you know, a bra is labeled nude. I'm thinking, when have I ever been able to match my, you know, breast to my bra color. I've never, it's never matched perfectly. Like,
excuse me just for a second. Check, please. Okay, go ahead.
I guess I just, you know, it's like, I roll my eyes, like, what, these kids' priorities are so misaligned. You know,
yeah.
Blaming, that's, by the way, that's the fault of the professors who, you know, harp in their ear all day long about what they want these kids to be fired up about. But here we have a legitimate rape, right? These college kids are so worried about rape. We have a legitimate situation where these young girls are getting raped. And all, what do they care about? They care about, you know, because bras and Band-Aids aren't in a rainbow of colors, which is actually, that's capitalism. That's the market working
yes.
magic. I mean, you know,
yeah.
if there was a demand for that, they would make them. Right.
Well, what about that is really strange because not being a customer of brassieres per se myself, I have purchased the occasional bra in my lifetime, and I don't know if I've ever purchased a white bra in my entire life. It's always a funky color. You know, it's always a red or a black or a. You know what I mean? Men don't buy white bras. Only women do. So obviously there are different color. I mean, I can't walk into a Victoria's Secret. I can't do it. It's too embarrassing. I can't. I've tried. I mean, I say you got that special someone, and they go, oh, you know, why don't you get me a gift? You know, and you walk in there, and there's all these ladies unmentionables, and I can't do it. I can't, how can I help you? Well, you could show me the door. That would help me greatly. I can't sit there and mix and match. I can't do it. So I just go, pick me out something. You know, she's about your size, and then there we go. But it's never white. It's always some red satin or black lacy or boy pants or something like that. So what's the argument here? They come in all colors is my point.
Yeah,
they
do, and... I, you know what, personally for me, you know, well, I shouldn't go there. Let me just say
No, go ahead. Personally for you, what? You were about to tell us what you wear
colored
personally,
bras.
And we are waiting with bated breath. What?
I don't like colored bras like red or blue or green because they always show up under my shirt.
That's right.
So I always buy like really just soft colors, white
what?
Or beige
people
or whatever.
People are not, the point is this, people are not trying to match their skin color, they're trying to match their clothing.
Shirt, I know, right? Like who cares what color it is? It's under
right.
your shirt, except if it's a super bright color and then it does show up, so
you
I'll
know,
vouch
wait,
for that. But
people are wearing like color, their clothing that they're wearing goes best with a white bra. So it's not the bra that's racist, the clothing is racist. Let's get that straight, okay? It's not the bra. It's the clothing. We need to get – everyone needs to get straightened out. Listen, I've also heard about the Band-Aids, and something that I used to wear until I found a German product that's much better is I used to wear the Breathe Right, and when I would wear it was when I was boxing. You know what a Breathe Right is? It goes over your nose?
Yeah.
Okay. I would wear it when I was boxing, and what it does is it holds your nostrils open. It has like a – it's got more or less a spring, it's got like a spring built into it. It's a glorified Band-Aid, but with a spring built into it that flares your nostrils for you. And it lets you breathe. It assists your breathing, and it's really great for boxing because boxers, I don't know if you know this, but the big problem with boxers is in the late rounds you start breathing through your mouth. And when you start doing that, you're going to get the hell beaten out of you. You should know this for Krav Maga.
Yeah.
If you got to keep breathing through your nose. And
That's why they make me yell out whenever I punch. You know, they
yes.
want me to...
Right. And the more tired you are, the harder it is to breathe through your nose. So if you wear one of these Breathe Rights, which I highly recommend, by the way, Jennifer, the more you will breathe through your nose. So I used to wear one of these all the time. And I used to go to this gym in Pasadena where I was one of two white guys. The other... Now, just as an aside, the other white guy was the guy who played Q in, what was it? Was that the Star Trek movie?
Star Trek, yeah. He was Q?
Yeah.
No,
it
was in the
really
Next
well.
Generation. Q in
next
the Next
generation.
Generation. Oh, he boxed? That's cool. He was
yeah,
one of my
yeah,
favorite
yeah.
characters.
I knew him really well. I boxed with him for like 4 years. Anyway, we were the only white guys in there. But I wore this. It means nothing. I just decided to drop a name. And I wore these Breathe Rights, And people were always like, wow, man, what is that? And I'd be like, oh, these are great, man. And when I didn't have a breathe right, it was really noticeable. And my trainer would even say, hey, man, you got to – don't forget your breathe right. You're so much better. And then the kids, and they were kids. They were like in their early 20s, and all black kids, all – you know, this is a really dirty, dingy gym in South Pasadena. That's why I loved going there. And they'd always be asking me about the breathe rights. I'd say, dudes, go get yourself a stupid breathe right. And they couldn't afford it. So I bought everybody breathe rights, right? And mm-hmm. they all said the same thing. They said, man, these are racist.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because they were the color of Caucasian people. You know, they were color of, you know, your basic Band-Aid. So... Scott, you're going to love this. The next day, I came in with a Sharpie, and I put – God, I wish I would have videotaped this. I put a breathe right on everybody's – now, picture this, like 8 young studs, little black guys, 20, 25 years old, all of them. And I put breathe rights on all of them, and then I colored them all with a black Sharpie. I said, there you go. You feel better now. And they all suddenly realized how utterly stupid they were claiming that these breathe rights were racist because it didn't make a difference what color they were. You know, I taught them all something, Jennifer, is what I'm telling you.
Good, yeah. It's never going to match me either. That's my point. Like, it's not like I put it on and it's visible. I can
right.
see it too. And my husband, who has Scottish descent, I mean, he's so white, he's practically see-through. And those things stick out like a sore thumb because they're so dark on his skin. So it's not ever going to match anybody's skin perfectly. So,
yeah,
you know.
And it's all stupid anyway. I mean, no one actually thinks a bra is racist. It's an inanimate object.
But,
how
you know,
it
just
racist?
Starts to speak to the misplaced priorities of college students, one of the things that we cover, because it's just – they're so worked up about things that just don't matter and things
and,
that aren't right. I mean, it's.
And I know what the professor's thinking. I really do. The professor is sitting there going, well, I'm going to use this as an example, and it's going to teach them a bigger lesson about racism. But it never does. It never does. It doesn't translate. It doesn't mean anything. And, in fact, it teaches them the opposite. It teaches them to see racism where it doesn't exist. And that's the last thing you want to teach people, especially kids.
Well, you know what? You know, young people are searching for meaning and reason. I mean,
right.
our nation is it's becoming godless, right? We're turning our back on God, unfortunately. Not me, but, you know, that's the way that this nation is headed, right? And so now these young kids grow up, and they're like, what's going to give me meaning? What's going to give me purpose? Because basically I'm just, you know, dust. I'm a bunch of molecules and atoms that's going to turn back into nothing when I die, right? That's the way an atheistic worldview has. So what are they doing? They're looking for meaning. They're looking for purpose, something that they can get fired up about, something that can get them excited. And that's why they glom onto these, you know, ridiculous campus outrages, because they don't have anything else to get upset about. You can't get upset about Islam because that would be or whatever it is, racist or, you know, culturally, whatever. So, you know, what do they get upset about now? They get upset about stupid things that just don't matter because they're looking for meaning.
What do you say to kids when and Scott, if you're still there, I want to ask you too. In fact, I'll ask Scott first. What do you, you know, give me the Reader's Digest version. What do you say to somebody, a young person, when they go, hey, you know, I think I'm an atheist. You know, what is your argument to not be an atheist, or, you know, what do you say in a nutshell?
You know what, I do the exact same thing that's done all the way through the Bible. I take them straight to the creation and the creator. And I have them pay attention. You know, we sing the song Count Your Many Blessings. I like to play Count Your Many Creations. And look at the details of the eyeball. Look at the details of the ear, the brain, the human brain, the fingers. Look at the tree and how it works. Look at the fact that every living thing, including mold, has DNA. Now, DNA is a very complex thing. So if everything just kind of sprouted from one single cell that just accidentally somehow came to life. It had to have DNA in there because mold's got DNA, plants have got DNA, flowers have got DNA, animals have got DNA, man has got DNA. I would take them for about 15, 20 minutes and start describing how a tree works, how the human brain works. All of these things that there is no way could have happened by accident. We know what a mutation looks like, and basically evolution is based on a lot of mutation. I can take you to a giant oak tree up in the high country of California, in the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas, and I can show you what a mutation on a tree looks like. It's ugly. It's not beautiful. But if you take and you look at the butterfly and you look just at the insects, in fact, even if you look at some of the more basic things, at how detailed and how organized they are, you can tell that there is a creator. Now, once you've established that there's a creator, then you have to establish who that creator is. And I'm a firm believer that as you study that Bible, Jennifer, you were getting ready to head to a Bible study last week, the more you study that Bible, you can realize, even though it's got about 39 different authors over a period of over 1,500 years, that there's actually one author, because every single book works together. And it works together like a well-oiled Swiss clock, the whole entire Bible. It starts with trees, it ends with trees. You've got some patterns that go all the way through. And as you get to know that Bible, you can, the same way as you look at the creation, know that there has to be a single creator behind it. Nothing in the creation that we see could have happened by accident. The mind of an atheist is really the mind of an atheist, because they don't want the standards that come along with having a God. They don't want the standards that come along with having a creator. And that's where I always go, Rodney. I take them straight to the creation, and I just have them, I count your many blessings. I just keep going and keep going. Look at the toenail, how it grows and how it just happened, or hair on top of our head. It just happened, or our nose and the ability to smell, and how the nose works together with the taste buds in order to make taste for us. That just happened by accident. There's just too many. There's millions and millions and millions of examples, and maybe one could have happened by accident, but not all of them. And so to believe that there's not a creator just becomes insane at that point.
Hey, Jennifer.
And yet,
all
the professors are atheists. Isn't that amazing that they're supposedly the most learned, scholars of our, nation, and yet 90% of them are probably atheists. So I think, that goes to show you what that influence on college campuses, that they deny the existence of a creator, even though they, of all people, should know the implausibility of it.
Oh, exactly. I have a real hard time understanding how a scientist, especially a biologist or somebody that works in the life sciences, can be an atheist and not understand that there has to be an architecture. There's a blueprint, a little tiny blueprint in every living organism, every living cell called DNA. How can they not? I can understand the science, the physicist that's off in Never Never Land. Somebody that studies life, how they can't see it, I'll never understand it.
I always have the feeling, and Jennifer, don't you love this guy, Scott Osborne, Scott the Preacher?
Yeah.
He's something. He's kind of my spiritual guy, and he's helped me through a lot of ethical, what would you call that, Scott? You've helped me down these roads. I'm sure you can explain it better than I can. I always go to Scott when I... What?
On the line questions, really.
Yeah, I'm going to do something or I'm not going to do something, and I always got to call Scott and go, hey, Scott, I really want to do this thing, but, God, I just got to run it by you. Anyway, I talked to an atheist, and listen, my best friend in all the world is an atheist, and he goes into a special category because I really do believe... that 99.9% of atheists are full of crap, and I think they really just are frustrated with their own lives, and they just are disappointed. And a lot of us are frustrated and disappointed. I'm not saying that they're unique in that respect. I'm just saying that the way they cope with it is to say, well, I'm an atheist, and therefore life doesn't matter. My life is crap, but who cares? I'm an atheist. When it's over, and it'll never matter. It doesn't matter to anybody. It'll be, you know, a million years from now, it won't matter to anybody. A million years ago, it won't matter. It didn't matter to anybody. Life is not, you know, it doesn't continue after I die. So who cares if my life is miserable and it's crap? I think it's an excuse. I really do. I think it's just a cop-out. And when I talk to an atheist, I don't argue with atheists. I don't think it's worth my time because I really don't think it's a true argument. I really think there's something deeper. And I try to, you know, to the extent I can, I try to go around that atheism thing and get to something that I can agree with, and maybe I'll learn something about the person, and maybe we can get to their what's really bugging them, because I think it's bullshit. Pardon my French, but I think it's bullshit. I really do. Now, there is that tiny percentage of atheists who really are atheists. And I do know a couple people that I think, and I might be wrong, that I really think are really atheists, and I happen to be best friends with a guy that's an atheist. And I don't even want him to, you know, believe in Jesus. I don't want him to be like me. I don't want him because I don't want anything bad to happen to him. And I really do feel like if for him, after all these years, to come to Christ, I really feel like the only way he's going to do it is if something horrible happens to him or his kids. And it just, it maybe that's really bad on my part to think that way, but it just, it's an overwhelming
thought.
You know what,
Rodney? Yeah. The best thing you can do is just pray for him because...
I do.
You know, all right, because I was gonna say, you have to trust the Lord and trust his process with your friends who are atheists. Just like my dad was an atheist, but you're right. You know, you start to get older, and then maybe you start to think, hey, wait a minute. You know, am I gonna die and cease to exist, or do I have a soul? And it goes on, and I've been able to slowly but surely, you know, talk to him about God's love, and, you know, it's just a process, but prayer is a good way to handle your atheist friends. Because sometimes even I agree with Scott completely about the notion of creation and how powerful of an argument is, but their hearts are hardened. Their hearts are hardened, and they don't want to hear it, and they don't want to listen to reason.
Well, if somebody pushes me, I believe me, Uncle Rodney can slam an atheist into the ground if he has to. And quite often, I have to, because in the nature of my business, I'm a stand-up comic for many, many years. I'm in the entertainment business for 25 years. I'm a radio host. I'm a TV producer, and I get confronted a lot because I'm an unusual character in all of those businesses, as you can imagine, because I'm a right-wing, you know, what I consider a Christian zealot, and people don't put up with that. And so the minute they find that out, they want to confront me, and, you know, they'll push me. I don't, like I said, I don't argue about it, but listen, somebody pushes me, eventually they're going to get both barrels, and I do it with comedy, but it goes like this. You're an atheist. Well, isn't that convenient? You know, isn't that convenient to be an atheist in America surrounded by 250 years of Judeo-Christian morality and law, sitting in your little gated community, all safe and sound, courtesy of Christians and Jews. Congratulations, mm-hmm. Because the truth is, if I dropped you into a country without Judeo-Christian morality and law, say Darfur or North Korea, the irony is that 30 minutes later, after hitting the ground, you'd find God as you're being dragged through the streets and beaten. And that's a fact.
Yeah,
and boy,
that's true.
That argument's over. And Uncle Rodney.
Well, Rodney, you almost quoted scripture. But, you know, it really comes down to the best way, and praying for them, Jennifer, is exactly right down the line, and letting them see the difference in our lives. 1 Peter 2:15 says, always be prepared to give an answer for those who ask about your faith. And
I quoted
that's
scripture
the
right there, buddy.
Is,
right there.
There is supposed
Bam.
To be something
Everybody
different.
Everybody gets a taste of the bitch juice.
See what a good influence I am on you, Rodney? I bring you to almost quoting scripture.
Yeah.
There's supposed to be something in our lives that they look at and they see as different. Now, we all make mistakes. I've made some horrendous mistakes in my life. But the difference in my life is how I handle my mistakes and how I have forgiveness for other people's mistakes. In fact, I've got a lot more forgiveness now than I did when I was 20 over the last couple of decades of the mistakes that I've made in my life. But it's true. There's not much you can do because their hearts are hardened and they really don't want to believe there's a creator, because then you've got to accept a set of standards. But, you know, and we talk about this a lot when Jennifer's on, is marriage. And one of the best examples of way God's plan works is between a man and a woman. If you take a young man and a young woman who have never had sex with anybody but themselves, and they get married that way, they have got, number one, a lot better chance of making it to rocking on the rocking chairs when they're old people. They are going to have a whole lot more happy sex life, and they're going to be a whole lot less tempted to cheat on each other because they've got each other and they're satisfied, and that was the way God made it. Jennifer faces every day with young people in the college fix and the college crowd that have a totally the opposite idea of that. And that's why one of the reasons why we've got the divorce rates we have. As young men have had 5, 6, 10, 12, 30 partners by the time they get married, and then they're supposed to settle down with one, and they get bored. And then they tend to stray. And each one of the things that God asks us is not because he wants to be the mean old bully that takes away all our fun. Is he just knows, since he is the creator of the human body and the human condition, he knows what is the best way for man. And when we let them see that's more powerful than any argument we can make.
Well, I was so close to quoting scripture, Jennifer, I could smell it. I was really close. But that's okay. That's okay. I was right there on the cusp, and I'm still proud of myself. And I tell you, I must admit, at the same time, I'm almost quoting scripture, I'm also violating, you know, I'm also committing one of the seven sins, and that is, I'm not sure which one it is, but I feel really good about slamming somebody who's in my face about being a Christian. I feel real good when I slam them down. Is that pride, Scott, when I feel good about that? Is that pride?
Yeah, a little bit, and it's natural for all of us. You know, Christ did the same thing. Christ went in and slammed the tables in the temple twice. At the beginning of his ministry and at the end of his ministry, and that was really one of the handful of things that really got the Jewish hierarchy on his real bad side, because he went in and he got mad and he said, "Forget it," and he did. He slammed them both verbally and physically with his actions.
Did he kick anybody in the nuts? I think Jennifer might be interested in this part. Did you go in there and kick some nuts? Because I don't know. He was a Jew. He might have used Krav Maga. You never know. So listen, Jennifer, what is on the horizon?
You know what? Jennifer dropped.
She did? Did she take off? She had enough of us?
I don't know if she had to go or if while I was bloviating or if she got disconnected. That happens sometimes on
Blog Talk. Oh, man, you know what it was? I bet I dropped it. I bet I dropped it off my web. Ah, crap. That was me. All right. Darn, I'll try to get her back. Anyway. Oh, yeah, I did it. Shoot. My bad. Can you imagine? I just knocked off one of our guests. Whatever. Let's just get rid of her. Okay, I gotta get. You got your studio up?
I got my studio up.
Okay, so you're good to go. But you don't.
And I think we got the doctor is online. It looks like.
Oh, okay. Well, shoot. Hold on a second. Let me get back up here. So that was interesting. Another visit from Jennifer, and we should plug her website again. It is thecollegefix.com. And she's got her article over there, by the way, over there at joefromerica.com. This is Conover U. We're a member of, we're just a member of everything now, Contending for Truth Radio. We're over at TPC, which is what? The Tea Party Communities Network. We're also syndicated on the Pundit Press. We're everywhere, buddy. Man, you can't turn on your computer, you can't get away from Scott the Preacher and Rodney Lee Conover, my friend. And that's just the end of that. There's nothing you can do. We are everywhere. I'm very excited about that. Are you?
I am.
You, what, are you doing dishes now instead of paying attention to the radio show?
Nope, I'm just actually just standing here looking at, waiting for the terrain. We're supposed to have some cooler weather here in Texas, and I'm very much looking forward to it.
Well, I think Jennifer just dropped off. She doesn't care anymore. But that's okay. I didn't get to play her out music. But guess what? I get to play some in music. Here it goes. Now, when you hear that music, what do you think, Scott? That's right. It's Dr. Mark Brownstein from Sherman Oaks. He's a family practitioner, general practitioner, 25 years out in the valley in Los Angeles. He's my doctor for 10 years. Welcome to Conover U. Conover U, our regular doctor of record, Dr. Mark Brownstein. How are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm trying to figure out, can you hear me right now? Oh, yeah, good, good.
Okay, are you great?
Yeah, I'm good.
Welcome to the show. Welcome to the show, and it is 9/11. This is our 9/11 show, and it is 6/19 on the West Coast. It's 9/19 on the East Coast. Basically, we have another 3 hours in New York to go, and so far, completely uneventful. We're all very happy about that, and I know you are, too. And what's going on in your end of the world, my friend?
Well, number one, I'd like to express my sympathy for all the lives lost in 9/11 and lives that may be lost as we continue to fight the same enemy. And, you know, I went to medical school my first 2 years in Washington, D.C. I wanted to get out of California. I got into George Washington University. So I was in only blocks from the White House for 2 years, and then I transferred to USC because I was engaged and having a long-distance relationship. But I loved living in D.C., and we learned a lot about politics there and the politics of medicine. And down the street on one side where I was located in Foggy Bottom, there was the State Department, only blocks in another direction, the Watergate Hotel and the Lincoln Center, and then 6-7 blocks over was the White House, and then only a few blocks from the school, K Street, where all the lobbyists live, which I didn't know at the time, and where the lobbying firms tend to be located. So I was in the center of all this, and what they one thing they used to do, which is interesting, is bring in various politicians, for example, the president of the United States, physician, personal physician, would talk for an hour, or they'd bring in a senator or a congressman who may also be a physician, and various politicians, and explain that the power that doctors have in politics. And I remember one guy came in, he was a senator, I think his daughter was in our class, and this was in 1982, 83, 84, and she said, you know what's unique about being a doctor in Washington, D.C., and we're all just staring at him, we don't really know. He said, number one is that every congressman and senator has a physician. He said, think about that for a second. And what do patients do? It doesn't matter who they are. They confide in their doctors. They tell them things they don't tell anybody else. He said, so you're in a unique position to hear things that no one else is ever going to hear on the news, in the newspapers, in a speech from politicians. And you're sworn to secrecy, too. So they tell you things. So that I always thought that was interesting, and it turned out to be true. And so I've gotten to hear a lot of interesting things over my life so far in the last 24, 25 years of being in actual practice, especially things in, you know, being that I was born in Hollywood, California, actually, and raised mostly here, and now I'm in Sherman Oaks, only a few miles from Hollywood, so around a lot of actors, actresses, and a lot of, you know, left-wing liberal Democrats. And that's how I was raised, as I've said. And so, but in private, again, like I said on a previous show, they tell you things that are not what you hear in the media. Like the Democrats tend to really, when you talk to them alone and they're in private, an actor, actress, director who might be blackballed otherwise, tell you the same things that I hear on this show, same opinions. And really what it is, it isn't really, I don't even look at it as the Tea Party. I look at it as common, the Common Sense Party. Because really what they say just kind of makes common sense. You know, the Tea Party, it just makes common sense. Like, do you close the border? Well, no kidding. It's common sense. Well, these people, when private, they're different. They're not afraid to tell you that. Yeah, they believe, most of them that I've met believe in the same things.
Of course they do.
Do you subsidize? It's minimizing government. They get it. They honestly get it. They cannot. And those of you who don't live in the state, and especially in the Hollywood area in Los Angeles, and Brentwood, the Palisades, Malibu, where I kind of grew up, too, you cannot really tell anyone what you're thinking, or you never will work again, whether you're a cameraman or a grip or a set builder or the janitor at Warner Brothers or whatever. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what studio, as soon as, or a private studio, it doesn't make any difference. Paramount Studios of Santa Monica, it's all the same. You'll never work again unless you're Clint Eastwood, who can say whatever he wants because he's Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, but not till he's older. And same with Bruce Willis. And that's true. And it's the same with Bruce Willis and Kelsey Grammer and anyone else who's come out of the political closet. And I can tell you firsthand, I mean, it's absolutely true. And, I didn't come, even though I was a charter member of FOA, which is a Friends of Abe, which is a secret, well, it used to be a secret Republican, Hollywood Republican group, I didn't come out of the Republican, you know, political closet until I retired in 2008. Because there's no way I'm coming out. There's no way I'm telling anybody. And I don't know.
That would have been the end of your career, right? You would have never worked
again. Totally end. So, well, maybe not the end of it, but it would have squashed me 75%, and who needs that?
Yeah.
I mean, it's already tough enough to get jobs. It's already tough enough to get work. And I can tell you right now, even as a conservative, people say, oh, you only work for conservative. I'm like, what are you, high? Are you kidding me? I work in Hollywood. Even though I'm a conservative, you know, 88% of my clients are liberals. Are you kidding me? Forget about it. It's like people, you know, I was on staff at Fox News, when was it, 2006, 2007, whenever it was. And people, you over there with a bunch of conservatives. It's like, no, Fox News is not a bunch of conservatives. If CNN is 98% liberals, Fox News is like 84% liberals. That's the difference. It's just less liberals because you can't run a network with hiring only conservative Republicans because there aren't enough. You couldn't do it. It's impossible. I had a show called the Half Hour News Hour in 2007. This was a defined conservative Republican comedy show, the Half Hour News Hour. The guy who ran it was Joel Surnow, who said, I'm a Republican, and this is going to be a conservative answer to Saturday Night Live and the Jon Stewart show. And you know what? Even on our writing staff, we had far-left liberals. Because guess what? There aren't enough, you know, top-flight conservative writers. You couldn't get into there aren't enough of them. Because you're in Hollywood. You couldn't possibly make a living. You know, that's just the way it is. And so it's a joke to think that you could possibly come out and say, yeah, I'm a conservative, because you're right. Your career would effectively be over. If you sat around, Mark, waiting until a job came around where you could, you know, be yourself, you're talking about waiting around 6-7 years for each job.
Yeah.
Most of my career, the lion's share of my career, I've been working for liberals, and I'm not knocking them. Most of them are very decent people, generous people, and I enjoyed the experience. But they're far left liberals. I wouldn't dare tell them my politics. I don't want to lose my job. And I'm like, oh, you're paranoid. No, I'm not. I'd lose my job. Yes. I'll tell you right now, I'd lose my job. The blacklist is alive and well in Hollywood when it comes to politics, and that's the truth.
Well,
you're right.
Yeah, and I would go so far to say again that this is my personal anecdotal experience or belief that most the people that tell me their private lives and what they really think and their morals, ethics, values, et cetera, if you didn't know what political party they belong to, I would say the vast majority of my left-wing liberal patients in private, especially the ones that work in Hollywood, are really what you might consider to be a mild Tea Party member today.
Yes,
in the way they think and the way they feel and the things they want for their children.
Yeah.
In their personal lives.
Everybody is a conservative Republican in their family life, and that's what really frustrates me, Mark. I mean, I worked with a guy for 9 years at Sirius XM, and I've known the guy for 20 years. And he gets on the air, and he just spews left-wing liberal dogma. But guess what? I've known the guy 20 years. In his personal life, he would never let his kids, he doesn't treat his kids like a liberal. He doesn't. He's a member of the NRA. He has a corporation to dodge taxes. He does everything as a family man, as a personal, as a person, as an individual in his personal life. He does everything that in public he shouts against. It's just bullshit. I mean, and you know what it is, Mark? People in the entertainment business, they got this weird-ass thing where they want to be liked. They want to be, oh, look at me. I'm the person that gives you money. I'm the giving person. I care about people. You know, they're like bad parents when they're out there in public. But when they're in private, they let their kids, they're just Republicans all the way. It's just really weird.
I'll give an example. My dad, who's a physicist, he's 92, and my mom's 95. Like I said before, they both told me. Well, my mom's told me that they'd rather die than vote for a Republican. But my dad was a volunteer for World War II. He was fighting and killing Nazis for 2.5 years in Europe. He was in D-Day. He was in the Battle of the Bulge. He was in the tail end of the carpet bombing of Berlin. He fought with no break. They didn't get a vacation, but he felt it was important, and he was in the front line and in the Army. And he became a physicist and went to Cornell and Syracuse. He's smart, and he invented the LED, the patent for the LED, and he's a smart guy. And now, he's older, and he would never own a gun. He doesn't believe in anything the NRA says, because he feels too horrible about all the people he had to kill, even though they were Nazis. He had to kill so many people. Like he associates a gun with, he can't stand the thought. And he took us back to France to those Nazi bunkers where he had to climb that hill in D-Day. And he wasn't crying. He wasn't sobbing. He was just looking at it. It's almost like he's on a tour of, something really pleasant. And he took us to the cemetery where all the American soldiers are buried in France that died in D-Day. And he made sure we went to a concentration camp. He took my brother and I to Bergen-Belsen in the countryside of Germany, and made sure when we were 16, I was 16, he was 13, my brother, who was also a left-wing liberal Democrat extreme, he made sure we saw Bergen-Belsen that had very few tourists. Mostly they were Germans, and almost empty, though, and I've never seen anything like it, and mounds of buried people, 10,000 people per mound, and they're endless mounds, and victims of the Holocaust, and it was an extermination camp. So he made sure we saw all that stuff, and we weren't rich. We were lower middle class like that, $30,000 a year maybe, and we didn't have any inheritances. It was very modestly, we ate day-old bread. We were very frugal living. We bought clothes once a year at Sears Roebuck, during the Christmas sale. And so we didn't have a lot of money, but he made sure he saved that money for that because he thought it was important for us to see it. And so now I was going through his wallet. It was unbelievably, it's like the world's thickest wallet. It was almost psychotic. I felt sorry for him. So I do it 2 weekends ago. I pull out an ACLU card. I go, I've never seen one in my life. I go, Dad, you're a card-carrying member of the ACLU? I've never even seen an ACLU card. He goes, yeah, I am. He was proud of it, but yet he's the only person that I ever see that stands in front of the American flag every single holiday and sings national anthem out loud and says the Pledge of Allegiance, and no other neighbors they're all Hollywood actors and actresses in their zillion-dollar neighborhood now. That's because their house became worth a lot where they live in the Pacific Palisades. None of their neighbors have a flag. He stands up there and he sings, the whole block can hear him. And my mom does too. And he never is not funny to him. He's the most loyal American. He risked his life. He had his best friend. He talks about how they blew up next to him. He's talking to him 1 second. The next second, they're missed. They're just a red mist.
Yep.
And he can barely discuss it. And he took a lot of prisoners, and he brought back little souvenirs from the prisoners. We have a lot of coins, swastikas on them. He brought back from World War II. A few cameras. He freed them from oppression. But he's a pacifist. He's a left-wing liberal Democrat, a member of the Palisades Democratic Party forever, and he would never vote for a Republican, yet he's the most American guy I know, and he's at heart a Tea Party member. He believes in all the same things,
yeah.
But he calls himself a Democrat.
Well,
he would never
vote.
It's like a religion, like I said before, it's just his way of, but yet he's the most, he would die for this country in a heartbeat, and he almost did.
Yeah, it's this weird dichotomy, and it's hard to explain. I mean, you think about a guy like, well, think about the Clintons. Think about Bill and Hillary Clinton. Their whole lives they've been screaming about, you know, the National Education Association, and they're very pro-teachers union and all public school, and they're against charter schools, they're against private schools. Do you think Chelsea's ever seen the inside of a public school?
Yeah.
Hell no. She's never. She has attended the greatest public or the greatest private schools known to man. Same with Al Gore. Do you think or Chuck Schumer or Barbara Boxer or Diane Feinstein? Do you think any of these people who do nothing but scream all day about, oh, we got to have public schools, you can't have charter schools, you can't have anything, any private schools to compete with the public schools and the unions, blah, 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 blah. Do you think their kids go to these public schools? Hell no.
No.
Hell no, they don't.
When I was a kid, they did. When I was a kid, they used to, but that was back in the, 55 years old. That was a long time. There were famous people's sons, like Jerry Buss's son was in the owner of the Lakers, was in my gym class at Paul Revere Junior High. And
yeah, but Jerry Buss is a Republican,
LA Unified,
is he not?
LA Unified. He owned the Lakers.
But isn't he a Republican?
I don't know. Vin Scully's son was in the class with me.
I speak to people who go out and they say one thing, but in their private life they do another thing. That's what I'm speaking of. If you go out in public and you say, look, I support public schools, nothing else. I think the National Education Association and the public unions, teachers' unions, are the only way to go, and I am against charter schools, I'm against school choice, I'm against private schools, I think they're bullshit. And then you turn around and you send your kids to those same private schools. You know what? Even the head of the NEA, even the head of the teachers' unions, they send their kids to private schools. They know better than to send their kids to these crappy public schools. And the public schools were great when we were young. They were awesome when we were young. But
yeah,
they're not anymore.
No.
They were numero uno when we were young in California.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the same thing in medicine. Doctors in Canada, I don't know the exact number, but it's something like 90% get their medical care if it's anything important other than checking their cholesterol. In America, they cross over the border, and their wives are often nurses and work in America, so they have American health insurance, and they get much better health care. And you think, where did Boris Yeltsin go for his bypass surgery? He did not go to you think the Russian doctors are good. I mean, the best ones are as good as our doctors. He didn't go to Cuba. He didn't go where the best healthcare system is in the world, according to various people, right? He didn't go to Cuba for his healthcare, for his bypass. He did not go to Russia. He did not go to Moscow, to the leading university in Russia. He went to, I think, University of Chicago.
Right.
For his bypass surgery. Well, why did he fly to University of Chicago? What's that about? It's just right after the Cold War. It wasn't that long after. Well, because it's better.
Well, why did
their system in the world? That's why. Why would he go to the Boris Yeltsin go to anywhere?
When Michael Moore has a physical problem, do you think he rushes off to Canada or to Cuba? No.
I would think he gets healthcare in Cuba.
The guy's a multimillionaire. He's going to get the best there is, and that's right here in the USA.
He's a liar. He's a liar, and he's the biggest liar I've ever heard of in my life. In fact, one time I was invited to review a movie. This is the one time I was on TV, and Michael Moore was invited to review the same movie. So it was one of the leading actors at the time in Australia about 15 years ago. I can't remember his name, but I'm sure if I said it, everyone in the audience would know who it was. But it was they asked me, as this patient of mine owned a third of a TV station that was running this new movie that was going to be released, and he asked me if I would just do a review of the movie before it came out in the theaters. It came out in all the major motion, big theaters in Hollywood and Westwood and all over the country. And it was a dysfunctional alcoholic family and such, just from a medical perspective. So I did that, and Michael Moore came to this theater in estate.
Sicko.
Yeah. Well, no, it was where they record stuff. What's that called? A big
documentaries.
Studio. Yeah, they had 20 people there recording me just talking to an interviewer. It turned out to be Henry Rollins. It was a Henry Rollins show, and
okay.
They did some movie reviews. So Henry Rollins, Henry Rollins from Black Flag, the old hard rock band. He interviewed me for about 5 hours. And they cut my interview down to 5 minutes. They edited it down to 5 minutes of time. But then Michael Moore came. So I'm pulling out. It was a rainy day in Santa Monica in a studio, recording studio. There's nobody there except people working. And I left after giving my review of the movie. And then Michael Moore shows up. Suddenly all these TV trucks. Like the whole parking lot's full of these minivans with those satellite cameras. They're all there to record his opinion as a professional of the same movie. So they wanted to compare a common person as a doctor, like a common community doctor's opinion of a movie about alcoholism and dysfunction in a family, to a professional movie producer and director's opinion. Well, they asked me, do you want to stick around and meet Michael Moore? I said, no, I don't respect him. Why would I want to meet him? It's a waste of time, and I left. Yeah, I had 2 makeup people, I had 3 microphone people, I had 6 cameramen, there were 20 people there recording me and Henry Rollins sitting there in a chair facing each other. Mostly we talked and ate bagels. We talked about my older son's rock and roll band and how he advised not to go into that for a living. He said, don't tell him not to do it, it's the worst lifestyle ever. We talked about personal stuff, our family lives, our values. He's a really smart guy. But Michael Moore, I did not want to meet. Henry Rollins, I enjoyed talking to a lot. That was my only experience ever on TV, and that TV show showed about 15 times on cable TV on some obscure channel, and I never saw it, but for a month I felt famous.
Well, you were. You were.
In my own mind, yeah.
So let's talk about Obamacare, and let me preface this by saying Obamacare, as a news story, has fallen off the face of the earth, Doctor. I have not heard anyone in the media. I have not heard anyone in Congress. I have not heard any pundits. I have not heard any talk radio. No one is talking about Obamacare anymore. Almost like it doesn't exist anymore, like it's not a problem anymore, like it's not overwhelming anymore. All of the things that we've talked about Obamacare over the last year and a half, it's almost like it never happened. Now, in your office, I assume it's still happening, isn't it?
Well, I nearly went bankrupt because of Obamacare. I lost half my practice of patients I saw for 15, 20 years. Like I said in the previous show, multi-generations, grandparents, their children, their grandchildren, in some cases their great-grandchildren that I've been seeing for 20 or more years. Lost half, 50% of my practice, let's say 1,000 patients out of 2,000. I almost had to declare bankruptcy. And somehow I worked around. I did a workaround. Like I'm 24 with Chloe. I did a workaround. And I thought of some things I could do on the cash side to make a little extra money that offered extra services in my practice. And I work alone. I'm a solo private. I'm one of the few remaining solo private physicians in the country and that are struggling to survive. And every year our costs go up of practicing, and my cost is about $20,000 a month before I make a pre-tax penny and before I pay my malpractice insurance, before I pay anything. So it's very expensive to be alone. And Obamacare, what the thing about Obamacare is that you this is, I'll give you one example of the irony, the hypocrisy of Obamacare, the Accountability Care Act. If you live in California, UCLA is one of the best hospitals in the country. It's right near where I work. Okay, so I used to send a lot of patients to UCLA, and I went to undergraduate school there, so I know a lot of doctors there. Obamacare is, UCLA is a public hospital, you know, it's a California hospital, it's a University of California. It's paid for, you know, subsidized by tax money. It's for the people of California. They do not accept Obamacare. Not a single doctor at UCLA takes Obamacare. Nobody. Think of, I mean, if,
well, how do people pay? How do people pay for their care then?
Well, guess where I sent? I sent them to Cedars-Sinai, where I'm also affiliated with. Cedars-Sinai accepts Obamacare in their private hospital. And Cedars-Sinai exists for one reason. Jewish doctors were not allowed to admit patients in any hospitals in Los Angeles until 1970-something. So they had to start their own hospital system, and they started Cedars-Sinai. It was a private
Hold on. Back up. Jewish doctors were not able to admit patients in Los Angeles until the 70s?
Late 60s, early 70s.
Why?
Well, I might be off on that by a couple of years. It could be mid-60s, 65.
Okay, but well, whatever the date, why?
Because of anti-Semitism.
But that was a law? I mean, that was a city?
No hospital staff would allow them to join, so they could not join any of the existing hospitals. That was more in Hollywood Presbyterian Hospital on Sunset Boulevard in the middle of Hollywood, the middle of all the libs. That was a private hospital, still is. It's been there for 80 years. There's not a single Jew on the staff.
Ever. Wow. I did not know that.
There was not a single hospital of Jewish doctors. That's why a lot of Jewish doctors train in Canada, because they were not allowed to go into medical schools either. My dad, after World War II, got into Columbia University in New York, and he was the number one pick. He's a genius. He has 70 patents now, 300 unique articles in solid-state physics. He's an icon in America, plus he saved our asses. We're only talking right now because of my dad and the likes of him, the bravest generation that ever lived.
Wow.
And climbing that cliff in D-Day, that was only one thing he did. I can't even tell you all those things. And the number of Nazis he killed. So my dad, after that, got into Columbia University in New York. The president of Columbia called him in his office and said, his name's Ruben. He said, Ruben, you're our number one pick as a science undergrad. And you have the GI Bill, you have it funded, but we met our Jewish quota. I can't let you in. So he went to NYU instead.
Wow.
For undergrad. Then he went to Syracuse, Ivy League school, for 6 years for his PhD. And then the irony is after that, he went to Columbia, back to Columbia. By then, they didn't have a Jewish quota.
Oh, okay.
The postgraduate worked there for 2 years. But there was a Jewish quota. So there's a lot of anti-Semitism. So you talk about prejudice against blacks. Has there ever been a Jewish president or vice president? No. How many Jews are blocking and rioting and tearing down and burning down their neighborhoods because there's not been a Jewish president or vice president in Jacksonville, wherever, or any of the other, I mean, in Missouri or anywhere else? No one. No one riots. No one burns down their own. Anyway, so I'm just saying that Cedars-Sinai does accept Obamacare. That's in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
Right? Where every movie star goes to Beverly Hills. All the movie stars, Oprah Winfrey, Barbara Streisand, Bruce Willis, I've seen him in Malibu, in his convertible, and his beautiful, beautiful $150,000 Mustang convertible. It's a Cobra. I've watched him. You go there. I grew up near Malibu, so you see a lot of these movie stars there, and so they all live there. And so, but they go to all their doctors in Beverly Hills. They're all Jewish doctors on the staff at Cedars-Sinai in Beverly Hills. That's what Beverly Hills is, Cedars-Sinai. And the hospital only exists and has a Star of David on the roof. Giant, you know, 30-foot Star of David. There's no other hospital like that I've ever seen, except maybe in Israel. And the reason it has a Star of David is the only hospital Jewish doctors could admit to. And it started as a private home in an Orthodox neighborhood in L.A. back in the early 1940s.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so anyway, but the irony of that, why does not the public the publicly funded through our tax money, University of UCLA, they don't accept Obamacare plans that are private plans, the PPOs, that are very expensive, the gold plan, whatever, the top-of-the-line plan, they do not accept it. Not a single doctor there. And USC accepts it. USC is for the poor people. USC, where I went to med school for my second half and my internship residency, that's in the middle of the barrio. But they take everything. They don't care. You could be. They take every illegal alien. One third of the babies in the United States are born in the women's hospital there. One third of babies in the country are born at USC Women's Hospital to this day.
What?
Yep.
Not in the country. You mean in the state?
Or close to that. I mean, well, when I was there, it was one third. It might be one. Maybe that's down to one fourth. That's a lot. I used to deliver six to eight a night when I was on call every third night.
Yeah, catcher's mitt.
Yeah, exactly. And it's complicated. It's so upset. I mean, it's not a small thing. But they're almost all no insurance patients. They're Obamacare patients. They're whatever. They take Obamacare. They love Obamacare patients.
Let me ask you this. If one were to open a business and your business was, let's just say your business were...
I have a business. I have a private business, yeah.
But let's just say a guy. It's just a guy now. He's not a doctor. This is a guy that opens a business, and he embraces Obamacare. He opens a business in a poor part of town, and it could even be like a mobile. It doesn't even have to be brick and mortar. It could look like a mobile station, like somewhere where you'd give flu shots. Okay. In a parking lot. In fact, you could get flu shots. And inside this place, you had a doctor or a technician that could draw, that was certified to draw blood. You had a computer technician really good at navigating the Obamacare website waters. You had a legal, not an attorney, but, you know, a legal person. You had an immigration specialist who was bilingual, and you had some sort of medical practitioner, and you had a double wide trailer that would accommodate all that. Could you not make a fortune signing people up for Obamacare and giving them the basic services?
No.
Gathering their information.
No, you lose your ass in a second. Because the overhead's so high and the reimbursements are the same as Medi-Cal.
But what overhead? What overhead?
Oh, I mean, if they're supplied for by paid for by somebody else, you mean?
Yeah, where's my overhead?
The salary, the double wide trailer, all the equipment. I mean, everything's paid for.
All I'm doing is drawing blood and making referrals, basically.
But I mean, who paid for the double wide trailer? Who pays the salaries of the? All those different people you just mentioned, who's paying for them?
Well, you know, the business would, of course, but we're not talking about 8-year professionals. We're talking about a computer person that happens to know how to navigate.
And how much do they make? What's their salary?
I have no idea, but it's not like somebody writing code. It's somebody who knows the Obamacare website really well.
All right, so $50,000.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. That sounds high.
Well, the overhead of that.
And not a lawyer. Not a lawyer, but just like a legal paralegal.
I would say the overhead of that is so astronomically high that with the tiny reimbursements that you get, the tiny amount of profit you make from Obamacare, with the best of the plans, which is why most doctors in L.A. don't even accept it.
Okay.
I'm not sure about other states. I get a lot of them because I accept it. I'm generous.
Is the money now sitting in an office writing medical marijuana prescriptions? Is that where the money is?
I just saw a guy yesterday. He owns two medical marijuana shops. He said he makes $90,000 in profits a month.
How many medical marijuana prescriptions could you write in a day?
I don't 50? Write medical.
No. Not you personally. I'm talking about a guy that does it. Could he write 50 or 60? What?
Well, this guy yesterday told me he has 300 clients a day in one of his medical marijuana shops, and the rest it's a factory that he owned before, and he grows the medical marijuana there, and he has a license for it.
Well, this is the age of Obama, my friend. Medical marijuana paid for by Obamacare, and guess what? That knows no age. Minors are going to be eligible for that. That no, that is not 21 or 18 years. That goes as low as Obamacare will let it go. And with that, I have to let you go because our time, unfortunately, is up. And I got to tell you, you and I could talk for 20 hours, but we're going to have to wait till next Thursday. It's Dr. Mark Bronstein. Again, very interesting discussion. We're going to continue this next Thursday. I'm going to let you go, my friend, and I'm turning it over to our pal, if he's still there, Scott Osgood, the preacher. What do you got, Scott?
Hey, great show as always. Jennifer is always great. Good. It's always good to have Joe the plumber stay on extra long and have good conversation with him. And the doctor, I'll tell you, I'm really enjoying our segments with Jennifer and the doctor each week. You guys go back and forth, and a lot of good things said. It's so important. You know, the big thing, and this is what I don't understand, is the common sense of some of these things. We've known for a long time that the Canadians have come here for their health care, but we've had such a messed up health care system. We haven't had a messed up health care system. We've had great doctors. And so it's been a great show. Hey, Rodney, we got in a couple of weeks. We got a great, great guest that I'm looking forward to on the 25th. We got him scheduled way ahead of time. Kenny McMillan. And he is the owner of course, McMillan Firearms. His dad created actually a couple of the weapons that our military has used over the years. And we'll let him tell us about that because I'm not qualified at all to even say the name. But he was one of the first to get feel the effects of Operation Choke Point, where the Eric Holder portion of the administration has decided that certain businesses just cut the credit cards off and we'll cut them off. So he opened McMillan Merchant Services. And if you're a business owner and you're listening, you know what a merchant service is. Those are the guys that bring you the credit card machine so you can swipe credit cards in your business and take money that way. And it's been very successful. We're looking forward to talking about Operation Choke Point with him and our Second Amendment rights and McMillan Merchant Services. Very important. I would highly encourage any of our listeners who have a business, who have a merchant service, to switch over. Not only are they very competitive, excellently competitive, they are standing behind standing up for our Second Amendment rights, and they donate a lot to different gun causes and so on and so forth. So we're looking forward to having him on in a couple of weeks, Rodney. And you're going to be here in Dallas this weekend. Looking forward
right.
to that. You
that's
are coming
right.
for the flip side.
That is amazing. Guess what? It's our second shoot date. Our first episode was on last Saturday night. Now, our second episode is on this Saturday. You can go to the Flip Side Show. com and see if the Flip Side is on in your area. It's a syndicated television show. It's a great, funny talk show in the vein of Jon Stewart and Saturday Night Live, and it's just kind of a mishmash comedy, and it's got a conservative bent, but you know, we make fun of everybody, liberals and Republicans, and we try to bash everybody, and most of all we try to have a good time. It's G-rated. It's a very family-friendly show, and we're going to shoot the 4th, 5th, and 6th episode this weekend, so I'm going to be in Dallas. But Saturday night, the second episode is going to be on, and you're going to love it because guess what? Guess who's on, Scott? Guess who is on the second episode? Ms. Janine Turner. Ooh, la la. Janine Turner of Northern Exposure fame, and she is, believe it or not, a conservative Republican. She lives... she has a big ranch in Seattle, but forever, and I think she has also a place in Texas that she lives, and she raises cows, and she writes children's books with her kids, and she's wild. I mean, she's got some great stories, and she's in a movie coming up with Hannibal Lecter, with, what's his name? Who's the actor who plays him? Very famous actor. I can never remember his name. Anyway, she's got some great behind-the-scenes stories, and, anyway, if you get a chance, check your local listings for The Flip Side, produced by yours truly. That's right, Scott, yours truly, Rodney Lee Conover. And I'm going to hand it back over to you because I know you got more business to take care of. But I'm glad you brought that up because we really are proud of our show, Scott.
Definitely, and that's Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins.
Kind of and I should have known that off the top of my head, one of my favorite movies and series of movies. But, yeah, we got some great other things going on. Of course, we've got our other shows coming up. We've got tomorrow, we've got Ladies Bible Class at 12:30 Texas time. We started the Book of Ezra. We should just about finish it tomorrow. It's a little short book. And then we're going to get into Nehemiah and Esther. Actually, Esther, the story, takes place kind of between Ezra and Nehemiah. But there's a reason why Esther's at the end, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. And then Tuesdays, we've got American Sovereignty Radio with Jennifer Montrose and Dan Wilson down in Florida, and Jennifer's in Alabama. And then, of course, on Wednesday, you don't want to miss it, War by Women Radio with Kimberly Moran and Christy Waters, and they are rocking. They have a great show. They do a great job. We're looking forward to that. And so until next time, the lady says 10 seconds next Thursday on Conover U, and we'll be back.
See you later, Scotty. Good show.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye. Bye, everybody.